On this episode of Skeptico.
I have to say I'm a little uncomfortable with you playing clips from previous episodes. I don't know that if it's fair to play a clip from what someone said without that person being here.
Well, frankly, I was curious
whether or not you used my clip. And I thought to myself, you know, if I go on with this guy and I say something that he disagrees with, so is three or four episodes down the line, are you going to say, here's a clip of Michael Britt saying this, and then criticize it without me being there to say, well, you know, here, let me clarify.
Let's break that down, because this could be the most important part of the discussion. Michael, I played a clip from your show. So if it was a clip that was out of context, I would understand that objection and we would deal with that. Was the clip out of context? Was it different? Did I edit out something at the beginning or the end that would add to what you said?
I don't think I did.
Stay with us for Skeptico.
Welcome to Skeptico, where we explore controversial science with leading researchers, thinkers, and their critics. I'm your host, Alex Sakaris, and if you made it through that cringe-worthy opening clip and are wondering what's going on and what is the context, I think we're going to need another segment of Inside Baseball.
Out of this world occurrences.
So remember this segment, Inside Baseball, some couple episodes ago when we kind of talk about stuff that's kind of rather obscure maybe to a lot of people, but is really at the essence of what Skeptico was all about. So if you will, let me engage in a little Inside Baseball here, because today's show is about a parapsychology experiment that was done in 2011. And that's obscure enough, but we're going to take it one level further, because what it's really about is a group of psychologists, group of scientists who seem to pop up out of nowhere whenever a parapsychology experiment that opposes the dominant paradigm, you are a mind equals brain robot and life is meaningless kind of thing. So these guys pop up in a very orchestrated psy-op kind of way, psychological operations kind of way. And one of the guys who pops up a lot, you've heard on this show, is Richard Wiseman. So here's the story. Daryl Bem, who is this highly regarded social psychologist, publishes this parapsychology experiment in 2011. And unlike 99% of other parapsychology experiments, this one kind of explodes on the stage and makes a big splash. And he's on the Corbett Report on Comedy Central, and he's in all these places. And boom, out of nowhere, out comes Richard Wiseman. Out comes other scientists saying, we not only object to this experiment and all these ways that it was done, we question whether or not psychology can even go forward with the kind of crazy statistics we use that allow people like Dr. Daryl Bem to come up with these crazy conclusions. It was really kind of an outrageous claim. And then they doubled down by saying, we're going to challenge everyone to replicate this experiment, but we're only going to give you 6 months to do it. And then they did that. And as planned, they got a failure of replication. And then they went out with that and they made a big splash out of that. And if you look at the science media covered that extensively. Oh, wow, there's a lack of replication. Hold on, guys. I know you heard that report about precognition and all that, but no, forget it. Richard Wiseman has saved the day. He's come in and told us that that's not really true. Now, the reason that I make such a big deal about this is that, like I said a minute ago, if you don't understand this as an orchestrated psyop, psychological operations, if you don't understand this as a conspiracy theory, if you just think, gosh darn it, that Richard Wiseman fella, he sure doesn't like parapsychology, then you will never understand any of this stuff, because you won't understand the motivation. You won't understand why his partner, Caroline Watt, who we've talked to on this show, has completely co-opted the University of Edinburgh. There's another case like the one we talked about last episode where there's this guy out there and he really thinks parapsychology is cool. So he sets up and funds a whole department at University of Edinburgh to explore parapsychology. And what has happened down the road is that's completely been co-opted now, right? So you have people like Caroline Watt and Richard Wiseman who've taken it over and turned it into not an investigation of parapsychology, but an investigation of anomalous psychology. Why people believe weird things. In other words, why do all of us who say, hey, this stuff is real, telephone telepathy happens, precognition, I don't understand it, but People seem to get premonitions of the future. That happens. Even though a majority of people say that happens, there is an orchestrated, well-funded effort to make sure that there's always a counterpoint to that from this group that looks very well-credentialed and very serious. But, you know, that's not even the whole story. Because to understand the whole story, you have to understand today's guest, Dr. Michael Britt, who has the number one psychology science podcast and is, I think, representative of this larger body of psychology science, if you will, and would fit in nicely with all the science-y news sites that you find out there. And the reason he's so important is because he's not a skeptic. He's not part of this grand conspiracy that people always kind of talk about. And in fact, this isn't a grand conspiracy. This is a tiny, tiny, tiny little baby conspiracy in parapsychology and science. But the way that it works is interesting. When Michael Britt reported on Daryl Bem's story, he not only got it completely wrong, but he had no idea he was getting it completely wrong. He, like the vast majority of the science media, has been so conditioned to a certain way of thinking, to a certain way of looking at evidence, that he cannot begin to deconstruct the extent to which he's been played. So when you ask him why he never interviewed the original researcher, Daryl Bem, and instead chose to interview this Richard Wiseman crony, he doesn't really know why. He just did it that way. If you ask why he reported on the phony replication and not the replication that was done with 90 replications from all these labs around the world, he doesn't really know why. And that's what makes a good psyop. Because you can't run the game if you have to go and manipulate all the little players in line. No, the best run psyop is from the top, where you just do a little tweak here, a little nudge there, and the machine turns out the result. And that's this episode's Inside Baseball. And it probably is enough of an introduction on this interview I have with psychology science podcaster, Dr. Michael Britt. Today we welcome Michael Britt to Skeptico. He's the creator and host of The Psych Files, a very popular podcast focusing on psychology, science, education, and all that good stuff. He's also an adjunct psychology teacher at Marist College in upstate New York. And one of the interesting things that Michael does is he offers through his website some apps about psychology and psychology science that he offers in a value for value exchange as part of his podcast. So kind of an interesting take on how to do podcasting. Michael, it's great to have you on. Fantastic that you agreed to join me. Thanks for being here on Skeptico.
Hey, thanks a lot, Alex. I appreciate the invitation.
Okay, so, you know, we kind of hinting around that, you know, thanks, wow, this is great. We both share this love for science and psychology, but we don't totally see eye to eye on everything. And one of the things that I think is great is that we're able to kind of push through that and have this dialogue, and we're just going to see where it goes. Because like I say, I really am interested in psychology. We even did a show from the APA convention, the American Psychological Association convention, a couple years ago, and we interviewed a bunch of prominent psychologists, as we have on this show, interviewed a bunch of prominent psychologists and psychiatrists. So one of the things I hope we can do in this episode is really dig into some of this stuff and the science of it, which is an angle that you always push in your show, and I do in mine too, so it ought to be good.
Okay, yeah, I'm looking forward to it. Let's see what we can get into.
Okay, so there's a couple of points that I thought where we had a shared interest that we could touch on. One is this area of demon possession that you recently did an infographic and an episode on. And the other, which I think might even be a better place to start, is your episode 174, which you titled The First Replication of Daryl Bem's Research on Psychic Phenomena. Now, we've covered that in Skeptico. We interviewed Dr. Bem. We also interviewed a couple of times Dr. Richard Wiseman, who was one of the people associated with this replication stuff. So I thought we might have an interesting chat about that. Maybe you can start with a little background about episode 174 and Daryl Bem's psychic precognition experiment.
Well, he caused quite a stir, right, a few years ago now, with a very unique study where, what was it? He showed subjects words that they, and he asked them to remember as many as they could. And then just after that, had the computer randomly select some of those words. And I think what he says he found is that the words that they remembered prior to this selection, many of them overlapped with this future selection. It's kind of, but what do you call that? Is that a precognition?
Right. Precognition, which, you know, if we're going to kind of take a step back and talk about the broader focus of parapsychology, which is this idea that we need to look beyond what traditional psychology has thought about mind equals brain and maybe look past that. There's kind of three main areas that they look at. Psychokinesis, this idea of mind over matter, which has been looked at extensively by Princeton, where they basically set up a random number generator and see if people can affect the outcome of a random number generator. They've done millions and millions of trials and have some interesting results there. The other is telepathy, this idea that you know what I'm thinking, I know what you're thinking. There have been numerous experiments done exploring that. And then the third is this idea of precognition, situations where the future seems to be creeping in on the present, either in the form of, so there's a bunch of ways people have looked at this, the deja vu experience, knowing that someone's going to call you on the phone and then they call you, all these things. So these are widely reported things that are happening out there that scientists have said, gee, you know, these are so widely reported. They are, the majority of people report having experienced one of these phenomena in various ways. Shouldn't we investigate it more? And that's what Daryl Bem did, of course. But the interesting thing, as you point out about Bem, is that because he is such a highly regarded social psychologist, professor emeritus at Cornell, and just really kind of a top dog in social psychology, the fact that he stepped into this arena, and then the fact that he got it published through a top-notch journal, did create quite a stir among the skeptical community. And before we even go there, I need to ask, you know, do you consider yourself a quote-unquote skeptic or someone who's a part of the skeptical community?
Well, you know, I'm not part of the community. In other words, you mean you've talked to more skeptics than I have. You know, I mean, some of the big names. My background for your listeners is that I have a PhD in psychology, social psychology primarily, which I got way back in 1990, then taught at Marist College full time. And during that time, I think what's probably been most influential in my thinking is that I taught research methods and statistics, the course that nobody looked forward to taking. But I taught that regularly for 10 years. Then went off to work in the corporate world, doing e-learning and all kinds of media stuff. So, what I do in my courses, be it research methods or even intro psychology, which I just taught this morning, we teach the various scientific methods, how to carry out a study, be it everything from a survey to an experiment, and how to avoid confounds when you set up and do your experiment. We want to be able at the end of the experiment to make a confident conclusion. I tell them, as was told to me by my many mentors, we don't prove anything with any experiment, but we gather evidence in favor of some conclusion. And then we wait to see if there are additional studies that support that or which way they go. Ideally, we have the ideal scientist who comes at it, without any particular bent, and who sets up an experiment so that it could succeed or could fail. Ideally they report exactly what happened. And so that's we shoot for that. It doesn't happen all the time, obviously, but we shoot for that anyway. So skepticism, I think there's a very close connection between skeptics and scientists, obviously. Years ago, it was in the, Carl Sagan's book. I read that, The Demon-Haunted World, back in the 90s, I think that book was. I've seen some videos of James Randi, Michael Shermer. I don't know if I read a Michael Shermer book. I might have. So they interest me because what's important for, if I can, you know, be on a soapbox, what I say to my students is, look, and this is maybe, this is, you know, psychology. What do they think it is? They think it's Freud. They think it's listening. They think it's crazy people. They don't expect that it's about the scientific method and that it's about statistics. It's about some, it is about some, you know, this hard topics that they didn't anticipate. It's about when you become a professional, you want to be able to give people advice that you know is backed up by evidence. And so that's where there's that connection between skepticism and science, for me, anyway. I don't know if that helped or not.
Maybe it did. I'll risk a slight digression to say, you know, one of my pet peeves is this notion that skepticism is closely linked to science. I don't think it is at all. I think really following the scientific method is what it's all about. And, you know, one of the adages I like is science is a method. It's not a position statement. So someone could be the most open-minded, curious person and still apply the scientific method without being skeptic, without being skeptical, right? So someone could come along and say, hey, I just discovered that the Earth is flat. And then someone say, gee, that's really curious. They don't have to be skeptical. They can just say, I'm really curious. I'd like to investigate that. Or more to the point, they could do a psychological experiment showing one effect or another. And the person could say, gee, I'm really curious about that effect. I'd like to change the control this way or that way and see what happens. So it's a small digression, but I think this link between skepticism per se and the scientific method is kind of misused, but I'm kind of maybe making a mountain out of a molehill. Let me play a clip for you and for our listeners. This is from the episode that we're talking about that you did with Daryl Bem. See if you can hear this. This is a clip from your show.
There are a number of issues with what Bem did. The first one, though, is that by unusual, we're talking about 53% of these randomly chosen future words versus 47% of the words that weren't on the list or words that weren't chosen. Is it a huge effect? You know, in other words, of the 10 words, are all 10 of those on this future test? No. Are 80% of them on the future test? No. So you could at first just say, well, I forget this. I mean, this isn't even a very big effect. You know, but you could argue, well, if enough people find it, other than Daryl Bem, if it consistently comes up, boy, that's interesting.
Okay, first, straight up, it seems to me like you're mixing up the idea of effect size and statistical significance. Maybe you want to clear that up for people. What is an effect size have to do with statistical significance, and how do we sort that out in a particular experiment? And Bem, in this study, publishes some really big, big numbers in terms of the p-value of this experiment. I looked it up. It's something like 1.34 to 10 to the minus 11th of his published study, which is a gaudy statistical significance. But you seem to be focusing in on the effect size. Maybe you want to talk about the relationship between effect size and statistical significance.
Well, I mean, first of all, I'm not a statistician, don't have a degree in statistics, although I've taught undergraduate statistics for many years. So, I mean, you know, you probably are better people to talk to about this kind of thing. Something is significant if it's, if you know, or we claim it to be significant if we think it will not happen that often. It would be good to have a statistician in on this, because I've heard statisticians say, look, it doesn't matter if it's 0.05, which is where we draw our line usually. You know, let's say it's 0.03 significance or 0.00003. I mean, we can say significant. We can't say really significant. And I wish I could explain that why. You have to, you know, I should look that up because I think it's a good point. So what are you asking then?
Here's what I think you're mixing up. You're kind of go to great lengths to say, gee, you know, he didn't get 8 out of 10. He didn't get 10 out of 10. his effect size in this experiment was like 2%, 52% versus 48% in one of the experiments. So that's the effect that he measured. But the way that relates to statistical significance, of course, is the number of trials that you do. I mean, the casinos in Las Vegas are built on a 52 to 48% difference in slot machines in terms of how much the house wins. So this relationship between effect size and statistical significance comes out in the wash when you do number of trials. And the other thing I think you're kind of mixing up there is the number of trials versus replication. So you say, hey, if someone other than Daryl Bem does this experiment over and over again, it might be important, which is, of course, the replication factor, which is important. But really what I think you meant to say is that if he does a lot of trials and he continues to get this result, then that's what the P score really measures. So what's interesting about this experiment is there was a ton of controversy that was stirred up about, you know, the skeptics got so upset with this experiment that they actually challenged the whole idea of how statistics and psychology are done in general. So here you have a situation where Daryl Bem, you know, Cornell, highly regarded, does it just by the book, the way that everybody does it, and he gets this really, really big number in terms of statistical significance. And contrary to what you're saying, I mean, the bigger that number is, generally the more reliable we think that the results are not the result of the null hypothesis. But anyways, that's what he does. And then they say, gee, we don't even know if the way psychology does statistics makes sense. Again, it's kind of a backward logic, is this result that precognition could be real is so outrageous that we kind of have to throw the whole thing out. But that's where I really think we were going. We needed to clear up with that.
Well, the point I would make, I guess, is that so Bem did something and he found a significant result, unusual. He could do it multiple times. It's not just the statistics here, though. But we'll stick with this first point. He could do it multiple times, as you suggest. But that doesn't mean he's doing it multiple times correctly. You begin in confidence is when someone else can do it too, using either his methods or something slightly different. So I don't know. You said something about trials. And again, because you can do something wrong many, many times, so you have to do it right.
Right. Well, but that wasn't exactly the objection that you're making in your clip. But so you were talking about effect size. You were saying, hey, there wasn't 10 out of 10 words. It wasn't even 8 out of 10 words. I got a cat who's going to mess up my lighting over here. But you said, you know, it's only this small number that change in a given situation. Well, what's important to realize there is that the reason that Daryl Bem set up this experiment the way that he did, like you're saying, you know, you could have done it differently, is if Daryl Bem wanted a larger effect size, what he might have done is gone out and sought somebody who was claimed to be a super genius at precognition, could do it all the time. But he wanted to do something different. He wanted to see if this particular trait shows up in the general population, and in this case, freshman psychology students, and he wanted to do it inside of an experiment that was well understood, that people had done hundreds and hundreds of times. So that's why he set up this little word memory thing, because that experiment has been done over and over again. His twist on it was the precognition angle. So that's why he intentionally went for what would probably be a smaller effect size. But in the end, the only thing that we can measure is statistical significance. So the larger point of this interview is that, and if you have something to say, you can jump in.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you mentioned that what he did caused a stir in the community. But the stir, it was a little bit over the statistics. But the stir was also about other things in people discovered in his methodology. The different numbers of people in the different groups. Now you're shaking your head, so I guess you don't agree with that. So why don't you tell me? Because as I understand, I mean, all kinds of ideas came out or points came out. For example, selective stopping. I don't know if you've talked about that? Okay. So just to bring the audience back up, that means that you run subjects, but beforehand you haven't decided how many you should run, which you really should do. You should say, before you do your study, I am going to need 60 subjects. And then you go and you get your 60 subjects. But if you go and get your 60 subjects and you don't find what you don't get a statistically significant result, you keep going until you get the result you want. And that either that or going to 20 subjects, finding what you want and saying, okay, I got it, I'm going to stop. I mean, you can't, I mean, you shouldn't really do that. So go ahead.
So there's no evidence that he really did do that. And I'll show you what a complete charade and just hijacking of science this whole thing is. But to get there, maybe we should jump to the end story, which is here's what was published in 2015, a study by Daryl Bem and others titled Feeling the Future, a meta-analysis of 90 experiments on the anomalous anticipation of random future events. And I'll read from you from the abstract. In 2011, Dr. Daryl Bem published 9 experiments in the Journal of Personality and Social Psychology demonstrating precognition. To encourage replications, all materials needed to conduct them were made available upon request. It's important to note that here is a guy who was very much into open science and was encouraging replication from the beginning. Continuing with the abstract, we here report a meta-analysis of 90 experiments done by different experimenters, different labs, exactly the kind of best science that we would expect, 33 laboratories to be exact, in 14 countries, that yielded an overall effect greater than 6 sigma. So P1.2 to the 10 to the minus 10th. That is a gaudy, gaudy statistic. And he says, this greatly exceeds the criterion for decisive evidence in support of the experimental hypothesis. I've listened to your shows. I don't think you are a fire-breathing skeptic or a disinformation agent or someone who's intentionally going out to try and mislead people. But I'll tell you what happened here. If you look at the timeline, Daryl Bem publishes this study that we're talking about in January of 2011. Then Richard Wiseman, who has been accused and has an unbelievable amount of evidence against him being deceptive in these ways, and I'll play you a clip from Daryl Bem in a minute where he calls him out on being deceptive. I've also interviewed Dr. Rupert Sheldrick, Cambridge biologist, who did a one-on-one debate with Wiseman on this show and called him deceptive. But here is how the deception was played out in this case. Imagine this. Bem publishes in January of 2011. The paper actually didn't even come out until March, but it was available to people in January. Wiseman comes out and says, okay, we're doing a replication of this. Anyone who wants to do a replication, you have to have it in by June. Okay, first of all, that is unprecedented, unheard of, unreasonable, and doesn't make any sense. Why would there be a time limit of 6 months? Are psychologists, social psychologists, supposed to drop everything that they're doing and try and replicate this experiment? Are they supposed to get the funding for it? Bem himself.
Did you ask him that? Did you ask Wiseman that?
not on this case, but just watch the way it plays out, right? I mean, this guy, Bem, was open to replication. And he did it. He compiled here, as you can see, 90 replications over the last 5 years. It's unreasonable for anyone. We don't even have to ask. It's transparently unreasonable to say that this is going to be the final finish line 6 months from now for all replications and then to hurry and publish your results. But he does something much worse. Let me then play for you the second clip, and that's from Daryl Bem, when he appeared on my show, and he talked about this very situation. Here you go. Hope you can hear it. I'll paste in a better clip.
Let me just, before you do that, yes. I have to say I'm a little uncomfortable with you playing clips from previous episodes. And it was one of the, one of the reasons I was apprehensive about coming on your show. I don't know that if it's fair to play a clip from what someone said without that person being here. Well, frankly, I was curious whether or not you used my clip. And I thought to myself, you know, if I go on with this guy and I say something that he disagrees with, so is three or four episodes down the line, are you going to say, here's a clip of Michael Britt saying this, and then criticize it without me being there to say, well, you know, here, let me clarify.
Well, okay.
I'm just not comfortable with this idea.
Let's break that down, because this could be the most important part of the discussion. Michael, I played a clip from your show. So if it was a clip that was out of context, I would understand that objection and we would deal with that. Was the clip out of context? Was it different? Did I edit out something at the beginning or the end that would add to what you said?
I don't think I did. Right. I don't believe so.
And I didn't even pick on the worst part of your clip, which is this intonation that you had.
I'm
just saying, when I play someone's clip from their own show, you can play any clip from my show, and I'm happy to talk about it. When in the pre-interview email exchange, you had a bunch of objections to my shows. I have no problem dealing or talking about any of those. The only way we can do it. Now I'm about to play a clip from Daryl Bem, which, again, I don't know why we would not want to hear this clip. It's not...
Let's listen. You know, as long as we're being respectful to all the people who, you know, agreed to come on your show.
If you think I'm not being respectful, well, I'll try and make sure that we do that, and you tell me if we're not meeting that standard. Here's Daryl Bem.
When you publish an article, even if it's of your own three experiments, you always have a literature review section where you talk about all the previous research and known research on the topic before you present your own data. And what Weissman never tells people is that they knew that there were three other studies that had been submitted and completed, and two of the three showed statistically significant results replicating my results. But you don't know that from reading his article, and that borders on dishonesty.
Okay, so here is Daryl Bem on Skeptico saying an even worse charge against Weissman, and that is not only did he create this phony deadline, Weissman had in his possession two studies that did show a replication, but again, he didn't include those in his little mini meta-analysis because he was trying to make a point, and the point was to just challenge anything that had to do with parapsychology and positive results, which is a pattern that many professionals in the field of parapsychology have claimed over and over again. What I thought was particularly interesting about the Daryl Bem case is it showed it in action, and the final result that I showed you, the replication of 90 experiments over the last 5 years, is proof positive, all that anyone would need to know. You didn't see Richard Weissman make any comment when the paper came out last year and said, oh, there have been 90 replications of this experiment now. I guess I was wrong. Of course not. That's not what's the game. That's not how the game is really played.
Well, you've been following this much more closely than I have. So I wasn't aware of that. I don't know if that means, so I don't know that I can comment on it. You know, I don't know. It's interesting.
Okay. So
I think, you know, you may be right in saying that the skeptic community is perhaps quick to put some things down. But it's probably, one could say that they're not open-minded. Or you could say that they've seen a lot of the research. And, I was listening to one of your episodes today where someone said that they strongly believed in something. Well, you know, it really doesn't matter how strongly you believe in something. Like every scientist, I'm just going to say, okay, well, that's interesting, but what's the evidence say?
Right. Well, that's why I'm glad what we're talking about here is the evidence and how we go about collecting the evidence and how we go about presenting the evidence. And that's why I think the whole thing with the skeptics is an interesting topic. And again, I don't think you're coming at it from a hardcore skeptical kind of stance, but that's the way it plays out in your show. I mean, the mere fact that you interviewed on this episode that you did, Stuart Ritchie, who is a grad, was at the time a grad student, right? I understand, but it, why not interview Daryl Bem? This was the whole setup, right? So Richard Wiseman props up this guy, Stuart Ritchie, who's a grad student, and says, hey, run out there and do this replication so I can go publish this phony meta-analysis. And these guys find all this goofy stuff that they say, hey, all psychological experiments are out because of the way we all collect statistics. It just seems really phony. And especially that was Daryl Bem's take on it. And I think the data bears that out. So I think you were led down this path of extreme skepticism by these guys, Richard Wiseman and Stuart Ritchie, who were really kind of running this game against parapsychology. And that's how I see it. You don't have to see it the same way, but that's kind of one of the points I wanted to make on that show. And I think you've responded, but if you have anything else on that, I'd be happy to hear it.
Well, you know, you're making me think about it. I have not delved very, very deeply into this research as much as you have. But I guess I am still a little skeptical. Let me say what I did do in preparation for the episode is that in an earlier episode, as I think I mentioned to you, you said something that skeptics don't read the research, right?
Right. Sure. A general statement. I mean, of course, some skeptics read a lot of the research, but in general, they don't seem real concerned with the research, right?
Right. And you know, I thought to myself, well, that's probably true of me. I'm not reading all the research on the various types of parapsychology stuff. You know, again, my area is in things like memory, teaching. So, but it's about critical thinking, which is why I devote time to it. But in any case, so I thought, well, let me go get something. So one of your interviewees, Julie Bichel.
Bichel, right.
Bichel, Gary Schwartz. And again, I don't want to talk with them necessarily with them. And it would be maybe a follow-up episode would be an interesting one to see how they might respond to what I'm about to say. So I got their article called Anomalous Information Reception by Research Mediums Demonstrated Using a Novel Triple-Blind Protocol. So interesting article. But I came away with it with a couple of things that concerned me and that I'd love to hear what their response is. So, and I think, you know, that maybe the obvious response here is, well, why are there only 8 subjects? So I don't know if you want to talk to that, but the, you might say, well, it's very hard to do. It's very hard to find people to do this kind of research.
Right. Well, she's replicated a bunch of times since then and then up to 50 and now it's up to 76. So, Go ahead.
But has she, so let me question, has there been 70, how many people are in any one of those? Is it 8 people each time?
It's different people each time. And I think when it's 8 subjects, it's actually 16 because they're paired. But
yeah, I know the research, the methodology is fairly complex. So I admire the work that went into this. But the thing is, you know, as I mentioned, I teach some statistics, though not a statistician. But if you're going to apply all statistics are based on assumptions. And to run a statistic on 8 people, the results of 8 people and lots of different means and things, well, you're really kind of violating what the statistic is based upon. There are assumptions of normality, assumptions of heterogeneity that if those assumptions are met, then the statistic is properly applied. If they're not met, then it doesn't really matter how big of a p-value you get. You've used a statistic you shouldn't have used.
Well, let me just tell you that Dr. Bichel has a PhD in pharmacology. So, you know, she is all about the statistics to an extent way past me, and I can't speak for you, but this is what she lives, eats, and breathes is these kind of questions. Her research has been analyzed by her peers, and that's why I use that term because it's been thrown around regarding her research, is really the gold standard of this kind of anomalous communication research because she is so rigorous in her controls. Because if you know, basically what we're talking about here, so we don't go over everyone's head, we're talking about medium readings, right? So someone's talking to the dead. And she decided to bring this into the lab and do it in the most carefully controlled way possible. And as a part of that, she immediately saw that what we had to eliminate was this claim that there is cold reading going on. Cold reading is the idea that somehow in some normal way, the person is picking up clues from the other person that allows them to give a reading that sounds good and sounds accurate. Mm-hmm. So that's what Dr. Beischel set out to do with her quintuple blinded study. So if you read the triple blind one, it's probably 2 years before the quintuple blinded one. And if it only had 8 participants, it was, which is really 16, but it's 8 pairs. That was the precursor to the one that had 52, I think, or 56. And that was the precursor, the one that had 76. So again, they spend years doing this research. They're compiling all sorts of data, and then they are carefully putting together, as you know, the work that goes into doing a published paper. So, you know, to really get into challenging her.
I'd be happy to. I'm sorry. So if I'm not so if this is not the best example of the research or just an early study, then, you know, I mean, I could email her and say, you know, by the way, why use? I mean, when you have so few subjects, you're supposed to use a different sort of statistical technique, probably a chi-square or something like that. You're not supposed to use statistics that are based upon the assumption that there's a normal distribution in the population. So I don't know. I wonder about that. I walked away thinking, well, I don't know. That's a major problem for me. The other one was that, and she states it in here, that the subjects had to be motivated. So how is, and that would be another one I would ask, what do you mean by that? Why would our subjects have to be motivated to believe? Just another red flag for any scientist, though.
I don't think it's that's okay. I don't know if it's a red flag for any scientist kind of thing. Again, anyone who goes to the Winbridge Institute and reads the published research, I think she handles all those objections quite well. She's been on the show several times, and we actually paired her against a skeptic who had, you know, thoroughly dug through and trashed her research. And it was a very one-sided fight in terms of Dr. Beischel handling all those objections. Again, her research has been attacked every way possible, and it's withstood all of that. So I'd be happy to do that, or I'd be happy to have a joint interview with you and Dr. Beischel, or just introduce you to her. Anything like that would be fine with me. So,
yeah, I mean, you know, I don't have an axe to grind here. I don't have a book to sell. I mean, you know, I do read research and teach research. So when I saw those two things, I thought, well, I don't know. That, you know, that's where I was a little concerned. Happy to talk with her about it, or, you know, she can email me, or I'll email her.
Okay. So, you know, the last thing I thought we'd touch on was really the first thing that brought me to your attention was your episode number 261.
And that's the thing. I had something else in my head, and so why is needing to have motivated subjects not a red flag?
Well, why would it be a red flag?
Well, because they're inclined to want to believe that there is some accuracy in the reading.
But you control for that, Michael.
Right? You don't want to use...
No, you can't say that. That's just a control that you have, right? So in her case, what she does is provide these paired readings. So you're paired with someone else. You're given two readings. So there's two motivated subjects who are trying to connect with the other side, if you will. They each get readings. The two readings are given to the subject who wanted to receive them, and then they rate that reading in terms of all these different measures that they have. And as a matter of fact, you know, that's why the only 16 that she had gives a lot of statistics, because, or a lot of data for statistical analysis, because there are so many ratings within each one of those readings. But those are the kind of details that she would handle. But again,
that's something that I would also question, because we can't. One of the things we don't let, and I'm not applying a different standard to her than I would apply to any other researcher. You also can't measure everything. And this really kind of came out with the BEM thing too. You can't measure 20 things and then say, well, these 8 came out, so I'm going to talk about the 8 and leave these other 12
out. That's not what you did.
You have to go into it. Okay, good, good. But you do have to go, you have to go into your study with a very, I'm going to measure these 3 things. Usually the fewer the better, rather than a lot. But anyway, go ahead.
If you read the research, that's what she did. She went in and she's going to measure beforehand. She said, here's what we're going to measure. Here's how we're going to measure it. Here's how we're going to score it. We're going to score it independently. So people who weren't even associated with even with either giving the reading or hearing the reading will independently score it. Then the sitter, the person who's actually getting the reading, they'll score it. So it's very complex protocol. That's why, like I said, researchers have said, gee, this is really the gold standard. We can't see any holes in how someone would do this. But I think if you dig into it and find something different, then that's great. I would just suggest to you, as someone who's kind of dug into it, is it sounds like you're kind of at the surface level of it, which is where we all start. So I'm not putting that down. I'm just saying,
well, no, let me just read from the study itself, which is in front of me here. She said there, from a pool of approximately 1,600 students, based on answers of yes or unsure to survey questions about his or her beliefs about an afterlife and mediums, as well as his or her interest in participating in mediumship research. Right? So it's like, why was that necessary? Why can't you just, I mean, ideally, you get, ideally, which almost never happens, but it's ideal, you get people off the street. We usually get psychology undergraduates because we can sort of get them to do these things. And then we randomly assign them to conditions. But we don't check them beforehand to see if they're inclined or even interested in what we're studying. So why measure their interest? You know, this is the thing. When I read it, I just thought, why is that important? And I guess that would be the question I would put to her.
Well, again, I think this kind of relates back to the Daryl Bem thing, and I think you're kind of going down the wrong path. It's all how you would design the study, right? So when I'm told you about parapsychology, one of the ongoing debates about parapsychology has been, should we pre-select people that identify themselves as being super duper at precognition or one of these other things, and then test them under the most tightly controlled conditions? Now, that would be a totally valid experiment, even though you've pre-screened for people who claim to have this ability. There's nothing wrong with that. That's just your precondition for the experiment. Instead, what BEM did is say, how does this apply to the general population? So similarly, Bichel can say, I'm going to pre-screen for people who are highly motivated to connect with people on the other side. And then I will control inside the experiment whether that bias, if you will, or whether that desire is actually influencing the experiment. And the way she does it in this case is through all the means that she has of controlling. So, you know, it really doesn't matter if she shows an effect. It really doesn't matter if all her subjects are highly motivated or not motivated, because there shouldn't be any effect. There shouldn't be this anomalous communication.
Okay. So, well, two things. I go back to the 8 subjects and the misapplication, in my opinion, of the statistics. So I personally, from a statistical point of view, don't have a lot of faith in that effect. So, I know, well, maybe that could be clarified. But if you bring people in who are, you know, motivated, then when you ask them, well, how accurate are these readings, they are going to want to look for accuracy. I don't know. You know, I guess that how...
Well, exactly, Michael. So that's where you have to apply the controls. And that's what Dr. Bichel has done, right? So if your motivation can have an effect inside the experiment in terms of the result, then there would be a problem. But in this case, it's controlled for. It doesn't matter how motivated you are. You still have to correctly pick the reading without any cues that was meant for you. So if you factor in somebody's motivated or not motivated, I don't care. They still shouldn't be able to pick a reading that suggests anomalous communication.
Well, but people can see things in readings. Well, how come? I thought to myself, you know, how would I have done that a little bit differently? Maybe what I would have done is not showed the reading to the person, but showed the reading to the person's roommate, their mother, their father, their brother, their sister, and ask them, how well does this describe this person? Maybe, I don't know. That's, I think, how what I would do, rather than have the person themselves rate its accuracy.
Well, that's essentially what they did. They provided the person two readings, one that was for them and one that wasn't for them.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah, but Alex, it's interesting. I just have some questions about the methodology that still doesn't quite ring for me. But yeah. I have that when I look at other published research. For example, there was a study done some years ago about the facial feedback hypothesis, which is where if you put your face into a smile position, you'll find things funnier. And I thought that makes a lot of sense, and I looked at the research, it looked good. But the recent research which has said, you know what, that's it's not holding up, not holding water. So I don't know. Why don't we just ask her for some clarifications?
Well, you would have to be the one to do that, since I've interviewed her like three times and have all the clarifications. But okay. I would be – any clarifications you get and you want to report back to me, I would be happy to update Skeptico listeners on what you find. And
are you, Alex, are you as open-minded as you say you are? Because you've said that the skeptics are knee-jerk negatives or whatever. And maybe they are, Are you?
Well, I think they're also deceptive. I mean, that's the other thing that I think we just have to – that's the thing that I think surprises people. Like if you dig into the Wiseman thing, this guy is intentionally deceptive. I mean, we did a bunch of shows, and like I told you, we actually had him on at the same time that we had Dr. Rupert Sheldrick, who was his co-collaborator on an experiment. And when your co-collaborator says – this guy was deceptive as heck. He changed the protocol in the middle. Then he published the results without consulting back with me. Then I had him on years later, and he finally admitted that his data matched his collaborator. And then he moved on to say, oh, yeah, but that data doesn't really matter, does it? It's the interpretation of it. It's just – it's a very a devious game that some of these guys are playing, and that's what I think is the surprising part to most people, certainly the people who are probably listening to your show and are just saying, hey, you know, Michael seems like a nice guy, he's just reporting basic, you know, psychology, science with a good in-depth educational angle. They don't see the game that's being played behind the scenes. That would be my contention. As far as me being open-minded, the only way we'll know that is by, you know, testing. I mean, I have 300 shows that shows that I'm open-minded. You have 300 shows that shows you're open-minded. People can kind of judge that for themselves.
But, you know, you say that you've seen evidence of Wiseman or whoever being deceptive. I would guess that they would say that there's lots of deception on the other side, right? So it's hard, you know, it's hard to know who to trust in the end, right?
Well, that's what we're both trying to do, right? So on your show, you're trying to help people sort out who they should trust, and that's what I'm doing too. And I think that's great because though you have everyone has to decide for themselves.
Yeah, they do. They do.
So I tell you what, you've been very generous with your time and very open in terms of this dialogue. I've hit you with a couple of really kind of very direct questions, and you've certainly withstood that. Do we want to talk a little bit about demonic possession? Because I think in a way it kind of also approaches some of these topics that I like to talk about and only pop up occasionally on your show, because the whole idea of demonic possession really comes down to the nature of consciousness. And that is, does our conscious minute-by-minute experience, that voice inside our head, can we be sure that that is 100% a product of our brain, or is it possible that there's something more, which is an open question among philosophers and even consciousness researchers? So is consciousness somehow fundamental to nature, to the universe, or is consciousness an epiphenomenon of the brain? Is it just generated by the brain and we unknowingly act as biological robots in this scheme? So that's what I think is the core issue of demonic possession, because once we answer that question, we can kind of close down those branches, or we have to say, well, that branch is open. How we explore it would be how we explore it. But let's return to the issue of the nature of consciousness. What are your thoughts on that? Because I didn't really find much from your podcast.
Well, I mean, I'm not a philosopher, and the things you just mentioned there, I don't know if we'll are our thoughts an epiphenomenon of chemical reactions in our brain? Or what is the other side of that?
The other side of that is that consciousness is somehow fundamental. So back 100 years ago, when the giants of quantum physics and Niels Bohr and Schrodinger were debating this issue with Einstein, this is what they were debating. Does consciousness collapse the wave function? Is consciousness somehow fundamental? And Einstein, of course, early on in the debate said, no, that's crazy. That can't happen. There isn't spooky action at a distance. God doesn't play dice with the universe. But later in his life came around to the idea and said, gee, I really can't come up with any other explanation for the results that these guys are finding. It does somehow seem that consciousness is fundamental in this way that they are claiming. So that's really, in a very broad strokes, framing up the issue from a physics standpoint.
I guess I'm more of a skeptic than I think. I mean, who wants to say Einstein wasn't the smartest guy in the world? But because he didn't understand it, doesn't mean that, I mean, that was 100 years ago or 80 years ago. Doesn't mean that it could be understood in a way that that he would have said, oh, yeah, you're right. Yeah, that makes sense. Right? I mean, not understanding something, and that's kind of the argument I made in the demonic possession thing. You know, Gallagher doesn't understand it. And he's a scientist, a psychiatrist. But that doesn't mean that it's not understandable or that there isn't an explanation that's, it's a little simpler, and I think, and that's if there's a bias that I have, it's that.
Well, what would be simpler?
That they're not possessed by demons at all, that they're suffering from a mental illness.
That's what I think is interesting, just in kind of broad strokes about that discussion. See, I think we get sidetracked when we immediately start talking about demonic possession and we don't roll it back to Niels Bohr versus Einstein. Because if consciousness does collapse the wave function, and by the way, the most recent experiments suggest over and over again that that is the case, and Dr. Dean Radin actually explicitly set up that experiment. I just spoke with them the other day, and they're already doing multiple replications. But in general, the results from physics have been that this thing called quantum entanglement and all these things suggestive of this reality of consciousness are present. What I think I'm saying is that until the social sciences deals with the mind equal brain paradigm or extended consciousness paradigm, we can't even begin to even address these questions.
But we have—I don't know why that would be so. Though, I mean, yeah, if we can find some evidence to suggest that what you're saying is influencing people, then we should. But we need to be critical in the way that we approach that. I mean, and I guess remember the history here, which is that we used to think that mentally ill people, we used to think they were possessed, were possessed, or that we used to think that the moon caused people's emotions to go wild but we've looked at that and we can't find anything there. So we should look at whatever will help people. It's just that the arguments for demonic possession didn't seem strong.
Right. So again, the point I really wanted to kind of get out there and really get your feeling on is this idea of consciousness and extended consciousness. And it doesn't sound like you're too married to one paradigm or another, or that you haven't really kind of considered that very much.
Yeah, I mean, I could not sit down with Deepak Chopra and discuss his theories because, yeah, they're fairly complex, right? I mean,
how about David Chalmers or Christoph Koch or, you know, any of the leading consciousness researchers?
Yeah, I don't know them. I've seen Chopra talk, and it's just like, well, you know, most people would refer to that as very new agey. I mean, it's extremely hypothetical. I mean, I don't say, you know, when we know that the neurochemicals between neurons, when those are affected, the mood levels are affected, then, okay, you know, and we can alter those chemicals and alter people's emotions and help people who have schizophrenia, for example, lead normal lives. And it seems to be working. Should we keep our minds open to some other approach? Okay. So I'm in a position to train young people to enter the field of psychology and become whatever, you know, to work with people who have mental illnesses. So I want to make sure, like anyone, you know, you don't want to go to a doctor who tries, I mean, you know, obviously if everything else has been tried, then maybe you should try something unusual. But if we have a cure or we have a treatment which has been shown to be used, then we should probably use that one first, right? So I just, when you start talking about consciousness and quantum physics, well, I don't have a background in it for one, and I don't know if it's just like, okay, how's that work exactly? What's the mechanism behind that? That's what I would ask. Although we're getting away from demonic possession, though.
Well, yeah, but we really aren't in a way. I appreciate where you're coming from in terms of, you know, we have to kind of navigate these territories, and you're trying to just take a reasoned approach in terms of let's try what was been proven to work the best. And I don't have any problem.
Well, let me give you another example for learning styles. So now I'm getting into, you know, as I mentioned, my background is in teaching and learning and stuff like that. I mean, so a lot of people believe that they have either a visual, a verbal, or a kinesthetic learning style. Okay. And it's interesting. It's very warm feeling. Oh, I'm a visual learner, for example, people will say. But when we do studies where we ask people or we give them some questionnaires and, you know, we find, okay, you are a visual learner, I'll put you in this group, and you're a verbal learner, I'll put you over here. And then we present information to them in the style that they believe they have, they don't do any better. There's just no, they don't learn better. But beyond the studies, we have to think critically and say, yeah, a lot of people do say, oh, I'm a visual, I can picture that. The problem is we also learn, for example, your people, your listeners, my listeners, we're learning auditorially right now. So you learn in ways that you don't know. You don't pay attention to it because you go with whatever comes to mind first and you go, I'm a visual. I need to do things. Well, if it's playing the piano or, you know, running a chemistry experiment, yeah, you need to do that. Hearing about a chemistry experiment is not going to make you a better chemist. So really the way for students to learn is that we have to look at what it is we want them to learn and then find out what is the method that will accomplish that goal, rather than to ask them, how do you think you learn best? So, you know, that's why we approach everything with this, like, well, you know, a certain, how can we test that out?
Well, you know, I think that's in a way a good way to wrap it up, because I think you've given people a good sense of the flavor of the psych files, really, because what we've talked about on this show, and you've been very open to doing it, is talking about a couple of areas that really aren't in your main swing zone, but kind of intersected with me in a way that I thought was interesting to talk about. So,
So let me ask you some of the things that I ask in that episode. So, you know, Gallagher says that he has people who've seen levitation. Okay, well, now you know where I'm coming from. I mean, that's hearsay, right? I mean, you agree with that? I mean, I don't know what to do with that. I mean, you know,
there's all of this has been influenced by this skeptical overlay that, as I've kind of pointed out here, is wrought with deception and agenda-driven apologetics. So the thing I'd say about personal accounts and anecdotal evidence is that it is always the precursor to scientific investigation. So when people want to throw it out and say, oh, that's just anecdotal, well, okay, we cannot use it in a controlled study, but it is the precursor to saying that we need to go and do a controlled study on that. For example, I referenced, you know, Dr. Rupert Sheldrake, and the first experiment I got involved with him and tried to help him replicate was this idea that dogs seem to know where when their owners are coming home. And the first thing people say, well, that's anecdotal. People say, oh, my dog knows when he's coming home. Well, when you collect 800 or 1,000 stories about that, like this biologist did, then he says, okay, I have enough evidence that something might be going on. Let me set up a controlled experiment to handle it. The same would be the case here with demonic possession. The fact that so many people report this would be a reason to say, gee, maybe we need to look into this a little bit further.
Sure. And the same thing with the phases of the moon or learning styles. People believe that they have them. And so we need to subject that to some kind of investigation. But it just seems like very often, just because people believe something, even if a lot of people believe it, it doesn't really matter how many people believe it, because everybody could be wrong, right? I mean, everybody could believe they saw something, but we really need to, that's interesting, and it's a starting place. But then we got to go further and find out, well, what can we do to replicate it? What can we do to see it again?
I completely agree with you, and I think that that's a level-headed approach that comes through again and again in the Psych Files show. Tell folks what else they might encounter with the Psych Files. And also, I really was sincere when I meant, I think you've taken a really interesting approach to helping do the value for value exchange in the show with some really cool apps that you have. So can you tell people, because we did jump right into the middle of this, more about what the Psych Files is about and more about what the apps are about?
Well, that's very kind of you. I appreciate that. Yeah, I mean, I've been doing the podcast since 2007. And so I basically podcasting came out maybe in 2004 or something like that. But I started listening to it and thought, hey, this is fun. Let me start my own podcast and see how that goes. Talk about the things that it's the same thing I do talk about in class, typically an intro psychology class, which means in a way, because people have said, yeah, but you're all over the place. You got stuff on leadership and you got stuff on demonic possession. You've got stuff on the Mozart effect. You've got stuff on borderline personality. Yes. So it's pretty broad, but psychology is that. You know, I feel sorry in some way for my students because a typical intro psych book is pretty thick, you know, and because the field is so you know, amazingly diverse. So anyway, I talk one or two times a month, like you do, about whatever's going on. Could be something that I observe. But podcasting is a difficult thing to support financially. I mean, the show has gotten so popular that, and I think it's mostly because it's just been around so long. And so there's like 13 million downloads to it. So, and a lot of students listen because I do give them ideas for their tests and things like that. Well, there's a lot of lifelong learners, but there's no easy way to kind of support a podcast. You know, if you're driving down the road listening to a podcast, and even if you think, hey, this is great, I'm going to give that guy a buck. Well, there's no way to do it, right? There's no mechanism for it. So, I have a technology bent, learned how to make apps for iOS and Android. And so I thought, you know, let me take some of what I think will be useful to people and turn it into an app. It's frustrating, but it is fun in the end. So I have an app called Psych Explorer, an app called Psych Test Hero. I think if people just, whatever, if they can either come to my website, www.thepsychfiles.com, which, by the way, you didn't mention that. The name of my show, The Psych Files, was because I couldn't find a name that hadn't already been taken. And I was watching The X-Files at the time, one of my favorite shows. So I thought, hey, I'm going to use The Psych Files.
Great. I didn't know that.
Yeah, that's where it came from. I was getting so frustrated, and it's one of my favorite shows. I'm a big, although I don't like particularly the latest few episodes, the latest revision or revival. I didn't think it was as good as the original. But anyway, I'm very big into that, very big into Fringe. You know, I love this stuff. Very big into science fiction and all that kind of stuff. And it's sometimes hard to balance that between that and a scientific perspective where you go, yeah, it's fun to think about, it's fun to listen and watch. But again, the responsibility comes down to I've got a patient in front of me, and what do I know right now I think is going to work. Anyway, so the apps are just there. They're a couple of bucks. And so if people want to learn more about psychology, come on over to www.
Yeah, no, it's great because it
come
is this.
Come on down.
Yeah, I think you've really hit on something. And I'm interested in podcasting too, because not only because I'm a podcaster, but I think the medium is really important. And the idea of doing this kind of value for value exchange associated with the show. And your point is so well taken about, you know, people would be willing to throw a couple bucks in the tip jar more than when they say, oh, sign up for a monthly $5 for the rest of my life thing. It's like, oh gosh, I don't know if I want to do that versus, hey, let me go, you know, grab a couple of apps that I would be interested in anyway. And I'm helping Michael out. I think that's a very clever and innovative way to handle this.
No, thanks so much, Alex. Appreciate it.
Well, Michael, it's again, our guest has been Dr. Michael Britt, creator and host of The Psych Files. Covered a lot of ground. We've really hammered on this skeptic versus believer thing, at least that's how it's framed up in the popular media. And it's been great. I love when we're able to have dialogue between people who don't seem to see eye to eye, but yet come together with an interest in just learning and exploring and trying to figure stuff out. So I thank you for that.
I agree with you. I think that in our culture, we avoid conflict, and I think that's too bad. So we had a really good conversation.
Well, great. And thanks again, Michael. And please keep me up to date if anything comes up after the show, and we'll stay in touch.
Sounds good. Thanks, Alex.
Thanks again to Michael Britt for joining me today on Skeptico. As I said, and I will repeat, I'm very happy that Michael joined me today, and I commend him for stepping into this arena. He knew it was going to be a tough interview, and he almost backed out a couple of times, but I'm glad he pushed through. This is a dialogue that needs to happen, and of course, these folks who are trying to prop up materialism do not want this dialogue to happen, and that's why it's hard to make these things happen. That's why this show gets slammed with all this false criticism about what I do to guests and all these things and all these misrepresentations about what happens on this show. But hey, that's to be expected. It's more evidence of the psyop that I was talking about at the beginning. So again, thanks to Michael for coming on for what was a tough show, but I think a good show. I have one question I tee up from this interview, and that is, what do you make of my claim about the PSYOP? I know that's out there for some of you, all that conspiracy theory stuff. I would maintain, and we can turn it into a question, that we cannot understand this situation with Daryl Bem, this misrepresentation, this hijacking of science by Richard Wiseman, if we're not willing to go there, if we're not willing to go to the PSYOP conclusion. If we just look at it as an individual player who seems to submarine good parapsychology, I don't think it's ever understandable. And I think that's one of the failings of parapsychology is, of course, they don't want to go there. And I think that's why we spin our wheels a lot. But do you agree? That's the question. Do you think I'm going too far out there in my conspiratorial little world here? So let me hear your thoughts on that. Of course, like I introduced last time, if you want to call me, you can call me and tell me your thoughts. The number is on the website, as is everything else. The links to the forum where you can join in the discussion. I'm sure we'll have a good one on this one. Or you can send me an email or link up with me on Facebook, however you like. I do have a number of interesting shows coming up on Skeptico. I can't even remember all of them. I have kind of too many things going on, but I think there's some stuff there that you'll really enjoy. I can't tell you how much I appreciate you sticking with me. There's not a lot of people who are interested in this stuff to the level that we cover it, and it's so exciting to connect with an audience who does care, who is interested, and does feel this information is important. So if that's you, thank you. If that's you, please share it with other people who might be willing to hear this information. So then, that's going to do it for this episode. Do take care, and bye for now.